Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who have been the most important champions of Native American rights? If we think primarily of warriors battling ethnocentric settlers and army troops, my guest today says we miss out on a host of wonderful and important stories of leaders who've worked by peaceful methods and with extraordinary resolve to establish their rights under U.S. law. And he's worked hard to share those accounts, first with his students, now with a larger audience of readers. Frederick E. Hoxie is Swanland Professor of History, Law, and American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His new book is called This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made. Fred, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Tell us about how you begin your undergrad courses on Native American history and what that exercise has driven home to you.
I started this several years ago without really having a big plan, but I asked students to take out a piece of paper on the first day of class and write down the names of three Indians. What are the first three names that come to mind? And for many years, I've done this experiment, and largely the same three names come up over and over again: Crazy Horse, Geronimo, and Sitting Bull. And I use it as a way to sort of begin talking with students about what is in their minds, what the popular culture tells us about Indians and about Indian history. And one of the things that I think it sort of says obviously is that Indian history is primarily the story of warriors fighting valiantly and losing and dying, and that Indian history is over. And that is not a very helpful way to think about the complicated world we live in today, with Indian people very much a part of our lives and Indian communities and nations all over the country. And so I use that as a way to begin that discussion of how we came to the spot we are in today.
Why did we end up sort of defining the history in that way? And I say we, I guess I should speak to the sort of broader American culture that may not be defined by Native Americans themselves. But talk about why we ended up with that sort of defeated warrior narrative as opposed to a host of other ways of looking at Indian history in this country.
Well, you know, that's a great question. And actually, one of the things that we often talk about early in the course is this idea of we and our history, and what is our history, and who are we? And if we define we as the American nation state, and if we envision ourselves as on this path of conquest across the continent, then we are on one side, and Indian people are on another. But if we are all of us, if we are the patchwork diversity that is America today, then how do we get here is a very different kind of story.
One of the most astonishing facts that this book drove home for me was that Native Americans were not guaranteed United States citizenship until 1924. How had their legal status been defined before the Indian Citizenship Act?
It was first defined by treaties, and so Indians were citizens of tribal nations. But as treaties were gradually changed, revised, undermined, ignored, and so on, Indians were put in a kind of a dependent limbo status where they were candidate citizens, partial citizens. There was a very complicated process in the late 19th century. Actually, some Indians did become American citizens before 1924, but it really wasn't so different from the status of African Americans after the Civil War, who were officially American citizens but who couldn't practice many of the rights of American citizens. Indians were in that kind of limbo world until 1924, when Congress actually passed a blanket statement.
So clearly it was a very long road to that point and beyond it. Let's talk a little bit about James McDonald, who would become the first Native American lawyer.
Right. Well, I discovered him as I was beginning this project, and I began calling him the first Indian lawyer, hopefully in talks and lectures and so on, hoping that someone would disprove me. But it hasn't happened yet, so I'm still calling him that. He's a remarkable a Choctaw young man who was educated by Quakers in Baltimore in the first years of the 19th century, and as a young man became a clerk in the Indian office as a teenager. He worked there, and then because of his contacts with officials in Washington, he had the opportunity to read law with a lawyer, a very prominent lawyer of his day, and then returned to Mississippi, to his homeland where the Choctaws were at that time, and in effect became a lawyer for the tribe in their negotiations with the federal government.
Hmm. Was there a strong relationship between the Indian rights movement, such as it existed in the early 19th century, and the abolitionist movement?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the answer is, like a lot of historical questions, is yes and no. It was certainly yes in the sense that there was a tremendous amount of sympathy for the rights of Indian people, rights of Indian communities to remain in their homelands on the east, particularly during the Jackson period when people were being forced west through the Trail of Tears and so on. But Indians at that time were not so interested in becoming citizens as they were in becoming, having their rights as tribal nations recognized by the United States. But there was a lot of sympathy and there was a lot of back and forth at that time.
So what's so fascinating about the time in which James McDonald was active is that there were still sort of active battles taking place. There was still bloodshed and conflicts being fought with weapons. He recognized the importance of political relationships as a tool for expanding rights. Talk about how he built those and how he used those relationships to further his cause.
It was partially a product of where he was. The tribes in the Southeast, who were sometimes called the civilized tribes, were tribes that had a long association, first with the British and the Spanish prior to the American Revolution, then with Americans. They had developed their own governments. They had, many of them were farmers, cattle ranchers, and so on. And so they had really ended their military conflict with the United States, and they really imagined that they were going to be able to stay in Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia on through the 19th century. But with the rise of Andrew Jackson and a very strong anti-Indian political movement in the early 19th century, there was pressure on them to get out. And this is really the moment that James McDonald enters the scene. And so they're faced with a kind of legal and political challenge that other tribes would in the West and in the Northwest on the West Coast wouldn't face for another generation or two. They faced it early, and McDonald, what's so extraordinary about him is that he really frames the argument that Indian lawyers have used right up to the present day, which is the United States is a government of laws. It's a democracy. It's a democracy that supposedly stands for civilized, humane treatment of people. And he said to the American officials, if you are a government of laws, then you should live up to your laws. You should live up to the promises in treaties and so on. He made the argument eloquently and worked with it, had some allies, but he lost. But that argument continued and moved through the century through other communities as well.
All right, so another fascinating character here is William Potter Ross. First of all, what sort of life did he have as a child?
Well, he was a pretty extraordinary character. He was a member of the Cherokees. He went to Princeton, not what you'd expect of, many people would expect of an American Indian in the 1830s. He went to Princeton, graduated when the Trail of Tears was happening and the Cherokees were being marched west. He was an undergraduate at Princeton. But when he graduated, he came to Indian Territory, what's now Oklahoma, and joined the new Cherokee government that was there. And that argument that James McDonald had begun is one that was picked up by people like William Potter Ross. He became a tremendous advocate of treaty rights, of lobbying with federal officials, making allies in the white political establishment, and also of creating alliances among Indian tribes so that Indians together could speak with one voice and stand up for their political rights within the United States.
That's a really interesting development, because I suppose all of these fights that were hard enough anyway couldn't have been won if they were done on sort of an ad hoc basis.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that William Potter Ross picked up very early as a young man coming to Indian Territory, where he came in on a terrible situation. These tribes that had been uprooted from the east, that were facing all sorts of internal divisions. There were also conflicts with the tribes, of course, that were living in that area that had been moved aside to make room for the Cherokees. And he became involved in a number of what they called international conferences, where the tribes would meet together and try to come up with a common political agenda. He even wrote a constitution for what was then Indian Territory to become an organized federal territory with a single government representing all the tribes there.
And another idea, am I correct about this, that Ross sort of wanted to maintain national identity for Indian tribes within the larger framework of an American identity?
Yes. I mean, When I was working on this book and doing research on William Potter Ross, I came across an obscure clipping in an Indian Territory newspaper that reprinted a speech that he had gave. And he said in this speech, "We want to be San Marino." And I thought, what is San Marino? And I began to look into it. And San Marino, as probably many people know, is a principality within the boundaries of the country of Italy. Hmm. And he made that speech just when Italy was becoming unified in the 19th century. And he said, why can't we be like the principalities of Europe, like Monaco, like Andorra, like these little countries? Why can't we negotiate our own government, living in peace with the national government? So he had a very cosmopolitan, very imaginative way of looking at the political situation he was in.
So as various tribes began to work together on these projects and on fighting for their rights, how did they sort of share strategies and information and sort of this worked and that didn't work? How formalized was that process?
Well, that's a great question, and that's probably one of the questions that I don't have a good answer for. But what I discovered as I began looking at these characters, and I really discovered them individually and then began to sort of look at how they worked sequentially, and then I began to realize that people who knew James McDonald also knew William Potter Ross and so on. There were circles of people who met in Washington who were aware of each other because they wrote letters, because they gave speeches and so on. And it really was a kind of an informal network. I mean, American Indians often talk about the moccasin telegraph, and there was a little bit of that kind of thing, I think, going on in the 19th century. By the end of the 19th century, with the railroad and with the concentration of power in Washington after the Civil War, more and more Indian leaders found themselves in Washington, testifying before Congress and so on. And it really was there where a lot of these people began to meet one another and interact with one another.
Sarah Winnemucca became the first American Indian woman to publish a book in the United States and came certainly from a background that didn't set her up easily to sort of become a writer. Can you tell us about her?
No, Sarah Winnemucca had the bad fortune of being born really right in the middle of the trail that the prospectors traveled from the East Coast to the California Gold Rush. She was born just before the Gold Rush. And her tribe, the Paiutes, were on the eastern slope of the Sierra Nevada Mountains and on the California-Nevada border. So she witnessed as a child firsthand the invasion, the sudden arrival of settlers, and so she saw what the costs of what had gone on. She was a very bright young woman, and she worked as a domestic for a white settler, learned English, and then became an interpreter on an Indian reservation. And because she was the daughter of a prominent Paiute leader, the leaders would turn to her as an interpreter. They didn't always trust the interpreters that the government had, or they may not even have had them. But she became a remarkable go-between in the 1860s and 70s as a young woman. She was very poised. She was very articulate. She had great command of English from what everyone reported. And she began to not only be able to try to interpret it, treaty negotiations and at formal meetings, but she began to speak to white groups about the perspective of Indians on the changes that were happening around them. She began to be a voice for Indian people. And she really was a remarkable person. She had very little formal education, but she took advantage of her literacy in English. And then in the 1870s, as she became more better known and more confident and better connected, she began traveling the country giving lectures on Indian rights and particularly on the difficulties that tribes like hers had being removed and dislocated by American expansion.
My guest is Frederick E. Hoxie. He is Swanland Professor of History, Law, and American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His new book is called This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join it now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frederick E. Hoxie. He is Swanland Professor of History, Law, and American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His new book is called This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Back, Fred, for just a minute to Sarah Winnemucca, because this is so interesting. As she began speaking out to different groups, as she began to publish her written work, especially this book, Life Among the Paiutes, this was a time when, unfortunately, many European Americans would label Indian Americans, American Indians, I should say, as sort of savages. And yet the things that they had experienced at the hands of European settlers seemed much more savage than anything Indians had been accused of.
Yes. In fact, Sarah Winnemucca had a dramatic moment in many of her lectures where she would come out. Sometimes she would dress in native costume and she would speak about her tribal traditions and so on. And she would emphasize what she called the civilized nature of their culture, that women had a role in decision-making, that they cared for their children, that they were cared for each other, for the poor, and so on. And she would paint this picture of her own community, and then she would turn to the audience and she would say, "You are the sons and daughters of the Puritans and the Pilgrims. You're supposed to be the civilized people, and see how you're treating us." And then she would go into the crimes that were being committed and so on. So she really tried to turn the tables using that language in her presentations. She was very effective. She made partnerships with, particularly with women's rights activists of the time, suffragists and other people who were concerned about the humane treatment of people in the society.
Of course, as is often the case with people who are highly effective in one part of their lives, she had sort of a complicated personal life.
She did. She's just one of those people that you can hear her voice in her book, and as you read her letters, it's consistent all the way through it. She was a self-confident woman. She was very much a part of her own culture and community. And she liked to dress well. She liked to ride into parades on a horse and so on. But she had bad luck with men. She married a man who, while she was giving lectures, was taking whatever money they had raised and gambling it away at nightclubs and speakeasies and things like that. So she was embarrassed by that. Of course, this is the Victorian era where people were judged on these sorts of things much more very harshly, and so that created problems for her.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Charlene in Arlington. Hi, Charlene.
Hi. How is everyone today?
Very well.
I wanted to comment rather than ask a question because I'm a native Nevadan, and I grew up with my playground as a young woman, Pyramid Lake, which is in the heart of the Paiute Indian Reservation. And while the Paiute have been persecuted and belittled and maligned for many years, about 20 years ago, developers started eyeing Pyramid Lake as a possible tourist attraction, as it is a prehistoric lake. And I think now that the Paiute have their revenge in that it has become more of a tourist mecca, and they own it all, and all of the money that is accrued by this wonderful recreational area belongs to them. And I would ask the commentator or the guest today to comment on that, if he knew that and if he had ever encountered any of the modern-day Paiute who are managing their assets now.
Thanks for your call, Charlene.
Sure. I think this is a wonderful example of just the kind of activism that I'm talking about, that tribal governments can function today as governing bodies of their communities. They can operate their resources, they can manage them. People can be citizens of an Indian community and citizens of the United States at the same time. Now, that idea was just unimaginable in the 19th century, and it wasn't until people like James McDonald and Ross and Winnemucca and so on down the line began arguing for the presence and the validity of an Indian presence in the modern world, that Indians are modern people, that they deserve the same recognition as other people do, both as citizens and as members of tribal nations, that these kinds of things are now possible. Those kinds of developments are taking place in Nevada, but all over the country, with tribal governments managing and developing their own resources.
Tell us about the Mille Lacs Ojibwes.
This is a great community, and this is a kind of an example of this moccasin telegraph that I was describing earlier, because the tribes that had moved west from the southeast and were in Indian territory became very active in the middle of the 1800s in court, going to court to defend various treaties and other agreements. And other tribes picked up on this idea and did the same thing. The Mille Lacs Ojibwes are a small band in central Minnesota who had a treaty that entitled them to a relatively small tract of land along the shoreline of this lake in central Minnesota. Government officials appeared in the late 1800s and said to them that Congress had passed a new law and they were all to move to a new reservation. And the leaders said no, they wouldn't do that. They had a treaty that guaranteed them this right. They claimed something again that white people hadn't imagined. They claimed a treaty right. Because we have a treaty, we have a right to something. And the government had sort of thought of a treaty as kind of a contract which they could change any time they wanted. And Indians said, no, you've ratified it like a treaty. It conveys a real right to us. They insisted on remaining where they were, and the chapter I write tells what I think is a fascinating story of how they continued to respond to various machinations and maneuvers of the government to get them out of there. They wouldn't do it. They finally went to the U.S. Court of Claims, and they filed a damage suit against the United States for violating its treaty, and they won in 1911. It was a mixed victory. There was definitely a downside to it, but they're still there, and they're also managing a resort on their reservation as a consequence of that.
And I guess that the thing about that victory, too, is that it set a precedent that would be followed later on and could be followed by other tribes seeking to assert their rights as defined by treaties.
Exactly, and I think anyone who's been involved in a political movement and lost, you know how it feels, and you think, well, I quit. I tried, and I made the good effort, and so I quit. These people did not quit, and they stayed with it for year after year, decade after decade, and they were vindicated. The Mille Lacs people, it's just such a remarkable story. The mixed part of their victory is they got cash, not land, in return for their damage suit. But they used part of their cash to buy land. So they sort of were always looking for an opportunity to achieve their objective.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Tom in Dallas. Hello, Tom.
Hey, good afternoon, Chris. I was wondering if you just could explain why the Indians adopted the name Indian at the country of India. When I got it, Irish sort of adopted the name British and Explorer accidentally landed in their country, and it's just been a mystery to me all my life. I don't understand why they adopted another name for themselves. Of course, a lot of colonial countries had.
Well, the phone line was a little cloudy, but Tom was curious, Fred, about why Native Americans have sort of taken on the name Indians after the arrival of Columbus and other Europeans.
I think it's kind of the least worst alternative or the best alternative. From my understanding of contemporary American Indian leaders is that having a label, a name for this community of indigenous people of North America, people, you ask, I think most Native people will tell you they'd rather, like your previous caller, they'd rather be referred to as Paiutes or Sioux or Navajos. They'd rather be called by their tribal name. But in a political movement or the naming of a museum in Washington, the Museum of the American Indian, I think the preference is for a name that everyone understands applies to a group of indigenous people in North America. It's one of the reasons why not all, but many Native people prefer American Indian to Native American, even though Native American is used quite widely, because Native American is somewhat ambiguous of who's Native American and does that include Hawaiians and so on. So it's a term that it was obviously erroneous from the beginning, but it was the available term which people kind of picked up on and used, particularly in the last century.
Thomas Sloan was the first American Indian to argue before the Supreme Court.
Yes. A young man raised on the Omaha Reservation in Nebraska, sent to boarding school. He was sent to boarding school in part because he kept asking questions and being irritating to the agent, so he thought he would send him off to boarding school to sort of straighten him out. He came back, and the shenanigans were still going on the reservation, so he joined a law office, read law, became a lawyer, and really opened, not only was a, was first to argue a case before the Supreme Court, but he really opened a law office in Washington, but sort of the first of the kind of Indian law practices in Washington, that he ended up representing those people that I was talking about earlier who would come to Washington to lobby or to see about a problem related to their tribe. He would be someone who they could talk to and who could represent them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gary in Dallas. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, this guest would make a comment on and elaborate on the percentage of Native American heritage, whereas the government and the Native American tribes recognize that person being Native American. How did that get established? Also, elaborate on the fact that there is also one more nation within the boundary of our nation, that is the Seminole Nation. Those two, please elaborate.
Okay, well, the identity of American Indian is defined in a variety of ways. The Census Bureau simply asks people to designate their heritage. So, as far as the census goes, whoever designates themselves as American Indian is. The formal recognition of people as members of tribes is decided by tribes, and so it varies widely between the Hopis in Arizona, who have a relatively high level of heritage that is required to be a member, and other tribes who require that you be descended from someone who had been a member and don't have a, they use the term blood quantum, which is really a terrible phrase. What it really refers to is the percentage of your ancestry, which is, or your family, who have previously been enrolled in the tribe. But essentially, tribal membership is decided by tribes themselves as a governmental function. But the census designation is something that is much less formal.
So
Seminoles certainly are one of the many tribal nations in the United States. There's a Seminoles groups in Florida as well as a Seminole tribe in Oklahoma.
We get the sense here that Robert Yellowtail, who was a Crow, was sort of an heir to the ideas of William Potter Ross. Tell us about the sort of relationship between the work they did and about Yellowtail himself.
Yeah, I think that, again, these connections between people are just kind of come out of the, you hear them talk, you see their language, and then you begin to see some connections among them. Yellowtail was a young man born just at the end of the what the Crows call the Buffalo Days, after the creation of the Crow Reservation, Crows are being forced to farm and so on. He is sent to a boarding school in California. He returns to his community in the first decade of the 20th century and witnesses the arrival of white farmers who want to lease tribal land, ranchers who want to take over land, government politicians who want to break up the reservation and so on. And he becomes a political leader within his community, really a kind of a political boss, and he takes on many of the tactics that William Potter Ross had developed. He unites his community. He tries to get the tribes of Montana and other tribes together. He becomes very active in a pan-Indian organization, which ultimately is organized later in the century. And he uses those arguments, arguments about treaty rights, about the legitimate right of a tribal government to function free from government control and so on. As a young man, he lived at a time when people weren't allowed to go to Washington without the permission of their agent. They couldn't go to Washington to make a complaint and so on. So he grew up in that atmosphere, but he learned that having his tribe behind him, and again, being sort of undaunted by the intimidation of the Indian office, which assumed that Indians were backward and they knew best and so on, carried him a long way.
He also seems to have had a keen sense, Fred, of the battles, not that were worth picking, but the ones that were that could potentially be won.
Yes, yes. And he was very instrumental in the section of the book that I write about in the 1950s, when there was a kind of a backlash of politicians against the rise of tribal governments in the 30s and 40s, which had been part of the New Deal. There had been a lot of bolstering of tribal life during that time period. there was sort of a backlash against it, and there was an effort of what was called termination, which is the federal government said, we're going to get out of the Indian business. We're going to stop, we're going to dissolve the Bureau of Indian Affairs and so on. And it was at that point that, Robert Yellowtail and Darcy McNichol, another figure in my book, became very active in the National Congress of American Indians, which is the largest Indian organization, which civil rights organization, which exists today and is a very powerful group. And they organized a remarkable national gathering in Washington, D.C. in 1954 to protest this movement. And while they didn't completely destroy it, they sort of stopped it in its tracks in 1954. And it was Yellowtail and people like him who banded together to make that happen.
And it was also critical to him that people, tribe members, understood their heritage and continued to sort of practice the traditions that had kept them together as a people for thousands of years.
Yes, and there was a, and this was something that was a part of Sarah Winnemucca's story and other people's stories as well, because the many of their white allies, not knowing much about Indian culture, and of course coming from their own cultural tradition, assumed that an Indian person who would be an advocate of what they called progress and education would also want to adopt European standards of behavior and culture and so on. And even though Robert Yellowtail was a Baptist, he was certainly a Christian, he was a Crow nationalist, just as Sarah was, just as William Potter Ross was. So they, again, these were people who were really teaching the American majority that you can be an Indian and be modern. You can be an Indian and be civilized. You can be an Indian and still be a respectable person in society. That sounds kind of ridiculous to say today, but that was a big innovation a generation or two or three ago.
Frederick E. Hoxie is with us. He is Swanland Professor of History, Law, and American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His new book is called This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frederick E. Hoxie. He is Swanland Professor of History, Law, and American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His new book is called This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll go back to the phones now, Fred, and we have Christine on the line in Dallas. Hi, Christine.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The subject is very interesting to me. Thank you for having this on. I would like to ask the author about what I guess we would consider administrative genocide. I had the supreme pleasure of working for a tribe in the East, and what the conclusion that we came to was there were a lot of bylaws that were kind of, I guess, just handed to the tribe so that they could, I guess, establish themselves. And what was written into these bylaws was the blood quantum. And we came to the conclusion that after so many generations, there wouldn't be, the blood would be so diluted that there actually wouldn't be a tribe anymore.
Hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Well, this is an issue that is very important today. And that is that tribal, as people who are Americans who travel and move around the country, even though there are reservations and there are tribal communities, in most of these communities there are very significant percentages of their population who live away from the reservation and who marry other people and who then have created a mixed population. The important thing to remember is that tribal governments are political entities. They're not; these are not racially defined. These aren't like segregated racial communities. They are political entities. They're more like counties than they are like a homeland in the old South Africa. So as a result of that, these communities then have the power to regulate their own membership. And it has become an issue for some communities who have lowered their so-called blood quantum or their heritage requirement in order to maintain their membership. But this, you know, looking ahead 50 or 100 years or 200 years, this is going to be much more of an issue for communities to have to decide.
Can you talk a little bit, Fred, about the relationship between the poverty and problems with substandard education that exist even today in many parts of the country heavily populated by American Indians, and how people like Alice Jemison sort of recognized that relationship between government policy and social problems within these tribes?
Yeah, one of my worries in writing this book about these activists and really writing positively about the accomplishments and the achievements they made, one of my worries in this is that I don't want to be perceived as painting a kind of Pollyanna picture that everything is great. I think these people achieved a tremendous amount over the course of the last 200 years of history, in bringing Indian rights to public attention, to making a space within the American society and political system for tribes, for tribal citizenship, for treaty rights, and all of those sorts of things. But all of this political change and transformation and progress has taken place in the context of a kind of economic story which goes in the other direction, where Indian resources have been exploited by outsiders. Indian ability to use and manage their own resources has been undermined by shoddy educational system and by educational system that was run by outsiders. So Indian communities have had to sort of play catch-up. I mean, the first American Indian-run school district in the United States wasn't organized until the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Until that time, Indian schools were all run by the Indian office, and it's still a difficult process. But Alice Jemison was someone who could see that was going on. She grew up in the early 20th century in upstate New York. She was a part of an Iroquois community, the Senecas. And she was appalled at the environmental destruction caused by logging, by industrial pollution, and all the rest of it. Her solution wasn't just an economic solution, it was a political solution. She said that the government had to recognize the treaty rights of her community, and that the community should then be able to manage its own resources. But that was really only the beginning. Then you had to sort of have the economic wherewithal, the capital, the trained people, all the rest of it to do. And that's kind of where we are today.
And she was like a voice that would not be silenced. She had a column, and she was writing open letters, and she just was relentless.
Yeah, she was. And one of the things I don't know, maybe some of you have seen the new Lincoln movie, and in photographs of it has a scene of Lincoln giving an inaugural address, and in the background is a statue that was on the front porch of the U.S. Capitol building. It was a statue of an Indian sort of savage warrior being grappled with by an American settler. It was really a horrible kind of image of, mm-hmm. of Indian people. And she took that on in the 1940s when no one imagined that anything like that would ever change. Well, that statue's gone, and it's just kind of its absence is kind of a memorial to her ability to take on whoever she felt was an enemy of Indian people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We will go next to Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hi, I have a quick question about an issue that comes up from time to time regarding sports mascots, and I know that there's controversy and teams have changed their names, and one of the things I've tried to understand is when you have a difference, for example, between a team that has a specific tribe name, for example, the Sioux or the Seminoles, and then you have at the other end a team like the Redskins that sort of are named after a slang term, and then the names in between, like Indians or Braves or Warriors, and I was trying to see if I could get some understanding of where the controversy, you know, how it divides out, what's offensive, what's not, and what's the current status of the protests and complaints. And I'll hang up and listen on the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's a big and complicated issue. I think that the best I can do is to say that when people are represented in this way, it's often best to ask them how they feel about it. And we had the experience at the University of Illinois where we had an Indian mascot. And in the end, what carried the day was people finally understood that it was Indian people themselves who really didn't like this and didn't want it to continue. And once people sort of got that idea, then it's just kind of good human relations and just good community relations to say, well, if this bothers you, someone else might not see it, but if you feel that way, then we'll make this change. And I think that's what's happened in communities across the country, where Indian people, with political power, with visibility, have been able to say, we don't like being mascots. You may be honoring us, you may have us as the warriors and the braves and the strong people and all those things, but we'd rather be physics students, or we'd rather be valedictorians or spelling bee champions. We don't want to be mascots. And I think that's been the kind of general thrust of it. I should also point out there's a difference between school mascots, which are mascots of educational institutions that stand for human values and so on, and the mascots of private businesses, which is the Redskins and the Cleveland Indians and so on. They're much more difficult to change because they're in business for profit. They don't have any particular values to uphold.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jeff on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. My question goes to the rights of the Tigua Indians in El Paso. They have filed, of record, a claim to all of the land in El Paso and surrounding locations. And I was just really curious as to, you know, what are their rights?
Well, I don't remember seeing the Tigua in the book, Fred, but do you have familiarity with the situation Jeff's talking about?
No, I really don't. Land claims are handled by the U.S. Court of Claims, and the results of those claims are, in the recent years, have been cash payments, or in the case of the main land claim settlement about 30 years ago, where Congress intervened and actually did return some land to the community. But it's based, these are suits that are based on the interpretation of treaties and so on. And I know that the Tigua have been there a long time, but I don't know any more than that.
What's the official relationship now between the U.S. federal government and the governments of Indian nations?
That's a work in progress. The relationship is what the Bureau of Indian Affairs says is we have a government-to-government relationship. And I think it's fair to say that the general conception is that Indian communities, there was a time, maybe 100 years ago, when tribal governments were viewed as sort of like student councils. They were, you know, people could organize them, but they really weren't going to have any authority.
It didn't count because the federal government made the final decision.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what we have now are tribal governments who are operating, and the courts have quite uniformly said that they are the inheritors of the tribal governments of the pre-contact period, so that the Navajo tribal government, which is organized under a federal law, does embody the government of the Navajos going back from time immemorial. But they are not, and they are, so that they have inherited some of the sovereignty of the pre-contact, pre-American government. But they are not sovereign in the sense that Switzerland and France and Brazil are sovereign, so that they're still within the United States. And that's where this has kept a lot of lawyers busy and employed over the last generation, because as these communities have asserted their rights to tax, to regulate water, air quality, a whole range of things, there has been litigation, sort of where is the boundary between state and county and federal and tribal authority. In general, I think that my easy way of saying it is that they function like county governments that have certain kinds of rights, but not others. But they are a local governmental entity. But that, just to give one other example, they don't have the right, for example, to violate the Federal Endangered Species Act, even though a tribe may want to collect a certain animal for ceremonial purposes. If that animal is on the endangered species list, the federal law trumps it. And so, as I say, these things kind of go back and forth. It's a fuzzy line at the moment.
I would hate to let this entire hour fall away without talking a little bit about Vine DeLoria. And you write that his career as an activist and as an intellectual began under unpromising circumstances. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's remarkable for someone who became so famous, particularly in Indian country anyway, later in his life. He was a young graduate of a seminary. He put himself forward as a candidate to be the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians in 1964, when this organization was basically bankrupt. There were a lot of divisions among the tribes. It was kind of a low point of Indian activism. And Vindaloria was an unknown character. His father was a very well-known Episcopal priest in the Dakotas. Vine had grown up in the Sioux country in the West. He had gone to seminary like his father, but he was kind of a young guy who really hadn't figured out what he wanted to do with his life. And he happened on the scene just when this organization needed somebody new to kind of give it some life. And the other coincidence, it's all in the timing, you know, is that this happened in 1964. He came to Washington just as the war on poverty was beginning, when Lyndon Johnson was reelected, when the high point of kind of the social activism of the 1960s. And he was a brilliant tactician and a wonderful writer, and he put together a program to promote tribal governments, first as part of the war on poverty, but then beyond that, tribal governments he put forward the idea that the federal government should support tribal governments as agencies for community development. And so first in the war on poverty and later with other social services, he developed the idea that tribal governments could function best as the administrators, say, of housing programs or of education programs, things that had always been the exclusive province of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, of bureaucrats in Washington who knew best for Indians, suddenly was being decentralized and being administered at the local level. And he was really the instrument for that.
What victories are still elusive in the 21st century that may have to be worked on in the next few years and decades?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm not sure I can think of that, but I think it has to do with the powers of tribal governments and how tribal governments can function within communities. They need to be able to operate like local governments in other parts of the country. There have been tremendous advances in water rights and control over resources, and these things need to continue. I'd say that probably the most difficult issue right now is the police power of tribal governments. There was a really unfortunate Supreme Court decision a generation ago that Vindaloria wrote about, and which I talk about in my book, where
I'm afraid we're just about out of time.
Well, it's just that the tribal governments need to have greater police power over their own communities, and that this has been a difficult issue.
The new book by Frederick E. Hoxie is This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made. Fred, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can download the podcast and learn more about the show at kera.org/think. And we welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.